Web Services.
Hi everyone, this is Heart of the Cloud from Cloudonaut. My name is Andreas.
And my name is Michael.
And we're recording this on October the 9th, 2022. So this is our weekly show about all things AWS. So Michael, we are not too far away from reInvent, and this is the yearly conference from AWS, and typically the weeks before and during reInvent are packed with releases. But my feeling is that this week there's not too many announcements going on. So my feed reader is not too crowded as other times during the year. But still, AWS announced a few interesting things, and I think it's a good time to go over what has been released in the past week.
Yes, Andreas. And also what I observe is that the announcements are about very tiny changes. And I'm usually a big fan of tiny changes because those are usually the things that are missing that make our lives as users of AWS much easier. So let me start with one of those, I say tiny changes. I mean, I don't know how much effort this was on the AWS side, but for me as an AWS user, that's a tiny change that could make a difference. And the first one is about server-side encryption with SQS. Basically, what's new is that now if you create an SQS queue, by default, it's encrypted using SSE SQS, which is basically the SQS managed encryption key for encryption. It's not the KMS key encryption that you can also configure if you wish. It's the managed one. And this is available for S3. For example, it's called SSE S3. It's available for DynamoDB, where it's also turned on by default. And this just makes it much easier for us because by default, the queues are encrypted. And this is important if you have to check all the checkboxes in the security hub, I think, because sometimes it is required that everything is encrypted at rest. And with this change, it's now super easy. And also, it's very cost effective, because for this kind of encryption you're not paying anything additionally. I mean, it was available before, but you had to enable it. Now it's always on and you don't pay an additional fee for that, so that's, I think, very cool. What I don't like is that it's not for old ones, so I don't really understand why it is not applied to old queues, because it really doesn't affect the consumer or the producer side. So there's nothing about IAM policies that need to be changed because of KMS decrypt or encrypt actions that need to be added. This is really completely transparent for the user of the queue, so I'm not sure why they don't enable it for all the queues, but at least it's now enabled for all the newly created queues. Yeah, that's it. That's the news item.
One reason is maybe that they don't want to break anything, because when they change an attribute of existing queues, things like Terraform or other infrastructure as code tools might get a little confused. That might be one reason not to enable it for
that
old
might be
ones.
That's
what I can imagine. Yeah. But yeah, it's cool that AWS is going in the direction to enable encryption at rest by default for most services. I think, so it was some years ago when Werner Vogels on the stage of reInvent said this famous quote, dance like nobody's watching and encrypt like everyone is. And I think they are really rolling that out step by step to all their services, which is, I think, a very good thing. Michael, I stumbled upon another announcement this week, and I'm reading the whole thing. So this is Amazon VPC now supports two new CloudWatch metrics to measure and track network address usage. And I remember when we were working for a consulting client, a very huge enterprise that was migrating their workloads to AWS, they have been running into that issue that they were running out of IP addresses in their VPCs from time to time, especially when spinning up things like EKS clusters, Lambda functions with VPC interfaces and stuff like that. And the challenge there was to find a way to monitor basically the available IP address ranges, because the IP address ranges they could applied to their VPCs was very limited because their whole network was very fragmented, I would say. So yeah, this was a thing. And now I think what's interesting is that AWS provides this feature out of the box. So how does it work? I looked into that a little bit. So basically, what AWS is doing here is they are adding two new CloudWatch metrics. The one is called network address usage, and the other one is called network address usage peered. So the one is only for one VPC, the other is for the VPC, and the VPC is peered with this VPC. We'll go into that in a minute. And it's important to note that those two metrics are not available by default. You have to enable them. So there is a new VPC attribute called enable network address usage metrics. You need to set this to true. And then AWS starts collecting those metrics. I don't know why they don't just roll it out by default to anyone. I don't know what's the reason for that, but that's how it is. And it's a very new feature. So it's not yet supported by CloudFormation. It's even not supported by Terraform yet, but I looked it up. There's already a Terraform pull request on GitHub ready for review. So it's coming to Terraform very soon. CloudFormation probably next 3 years, something like that. What's the thing with that? So how does it work? How those two metrics work? So what I didn't know is, so I always thought, when I add an IP address range to my VPC, so let's say I just do 10.0.0.0/16, which is, I think, the largest VPC address range that I can specify, the /16 netmask. So I get something like 65,000 IP addresses with that, so version 4. And I always thought this is just the limits that I'm working in within my VPC. I thought this is basically the limiting factor. Turns out that this is not 100% correct, because there is something what AWS calls the network address usage. And by default, each VPC can have 65,000 network address usage units, which is a little lower than the total IP addresses. And you can request a quota increase up to 265,000 network address usage units. That's probably important when you add more than one IP address range to your VPC, which you can do those days. And the metric is basically monitoring the usage of that. And then the other interesting thing is why the peered network address usage is important and gets its own metric. That when you peer two VPCs, there's also a limit for the number of network address usage units for both combined VPCs. And the limit is basically for all VPCs that are peered in the same region. So it's only in the same region. If you peer VPCs from other region, it does not apply. I don't know. It's just how it is. And the limit here is, the default limit is 128,000. And you can increase a quota increase to 512,000 network address usage units. So that's when you, I don't know, when you have, I don't know, 10 VPCs or something, then you have to be aware of these limits when they are in the same region.
Can I ask a question, Andreas? This is for VPC peering, right? But what about Transit Gateway? Is it also counted in as peered, or how does that work?
No. With Transit Gateway, you don't have this limitation. So the peered network usage is only for VPC peerings. So when you do a Transit Gateway, only the limit for the one VPC applies, which is probably not an issue.
All right.
And then what I also didn't know, I was just reading through the documentation. I learned a lot with that. How many units do the different resources within the VPC require? So as I mentioned, an IP version 4 or IP version 6 address assigned to a network interface requires one unit. But for example, a network load balancer requires 6 units. I can't come up with a reason for that. It's just the way it's described in here. Also, VPC endpoint requires 6. Transit gateway attachment as well. A Lambda function, 6 units. NAT gateway as well. And if you attach EFS to an instance, it also requires 6 units. So that is maybe something to keep in mind. Overall, I think you should monitor those metrics, at least when you are working in a constrained environment where IP address ranges matter. Yeah.
So that's, I think what is definitely interesting is that probably most people think that the IP address is kind of the usage unit, which is not true because we have this like kind of additional unit, which is a network address usage unit, which probably no one really is aware of, that has never hit the limit. So that's definitely interesting. Yeah.
On the other hand, I think it's coming very close. So most of us probably are using a VPC with far less IP addresses used and stuff, and maybe paired with one other network. And I think you never run into those issues. I think this is really for complex network setups with many paired VPCs and stuff, and with really huge workloads. Yeah. Then I think you need to be aware of that. If you just spin up 2 machines or 10 machines, even 100 machines, you're not running into any issues here.
That's right. All right. So Andreas, the next one that I picked is also again a tiny addition. And I think if I remember it correctly, it's just adding a property to a CloudFormation resource. And this is how Aurora Serverless version 2 support is now landed in CloudFormation. Yeah, that's it. So you can now create a cluster in CloudFormation. And we have a review about the service, Aurora Serverless version 2 review that we can link in the show notes. From May 2020, and this is actually one of the missing features that we identified back then. And yeah, I think that's again like one of the indicators that CloudFormation is lagging behind a little bit, because it actually took them quite a while to add that to the resource property. And also for Aurora Serverless version 2, there is not much progress. So maybe we see something at reInvent, I don't know, not much is going on there. So what basically the main point of critique is that it is, compared to version 1 that has its own problems, it is too expensive. Basically, that's kind of the main concern. And if you're in a serverless environment, it misses the data API. So it's very hard to connect to from a serverless, like Lambda environment, for example. So we will see. Maybe we will see updates around reInvent here. If not, then I think we have to wait another year or so until we can give that a new update and the review. All right, Andreas, that's it. So CloudFormation support, Aurora Serverless version 2. That was my item.
Perfect. So the next one, the next announcement that caught my attention is the IAM Access Analyzer now reviews your AWS CloudTrail history to identify actions used across 140 AWS services and generates fine-grained policies. Okay, this sounds great. Actually, I thought that they are already covering all the services, so I was was a little concerned about that they are adding 140 services now. But okay, that seems cool. So how does that work? So basically, this is only one aspect of the IAM Access Analyzer. And how you get into that feature is basically you open an IAM role. And there you can, at the bottom of the policy section there, you can basically generate the policy for that role with least privilege principles, more or less, automatically, based on what CloudTrail collected, the actions that CloudTrail collected in the past. You can specify how many days you want to go back, stuff like that. What you need to have in place is you have to set up CloudTrail, and it reads the data from an S3 bucket. So the whole thing needs access to the S3 bucket that stores your CloudTrail logs. And I was running in an issue. I couldn't solve it. So I was trying to get that working for half an hour maybe, and I failed. So we are in our environment. We have an AWS account that we use to only collect CloudTrail data and I think config data. And all of the other accounts in our AWS organization sent their data to this account, to basically two or three buckets in this account. And I followed the instructions in the documentation. I changed the S3 bucket policy a little bit to allow the access analyzer running in another account to access the data, basically its own data from its own account, which it reports to our central account. But for some reason, I'm just getting incorrect permission errors, and I'm not sure what exactly the issue is. It might have to do something with because the owner of the object is the other account. Maybe it's something like that. But I was not able to figure that out. So I gave up on this after half an hour. But in theory, it should work, and it's probably much easier if you have it in the same account. And the only critique I have about this feature in general, the CloudTrail, using the CloudTrail history, is that the CloudTrail history is not complete because there basically is one important issue. It doesn't collect all the actions, basically not all the API requests you're sending to the AWS API. It misses data events from services. And you can turn on data events for some services like S3 and DynamoDB. You can do so, but then you're increasing the costs for those two services significantly. I forget the numbers, but I think it's really something like you're significantly increasing the cost, for example, for writing an object to Dynamo or writing an object to S3 by turning that feature on. So we have disabled that in our accounts because it's just too expensive. And also a lot of actions are missing. Michael, do you remember which service data events are missing completely from CloudTrail?
Yeah, so I actually did some research just before the show. So what we have is we have S3 data events, and I think they are kind of they are capturing gets, puts, and head requests, I think. Then we have DynamoDB that only captures put item, update item, and delete item, so it does not capture any of the read side actions. Which is a kind of surprising. And then we have Lambda, which only captures the invoke API action. But others are completely not supported, like data events for SQS, for example, like getting a message from a queue, sending a message to a queue. SNS is not in there. Event bridge is not in there. So I think what the problem with the access analyzer is that the team, I mean, they have lots of fancy talks about their, like, very fancy, like, stuff that they're doing, like, reasoning, automated reasoning, I don't know. But the problem is that they optimize on a incomplete data set. So they can have the best machine in the world to get, like, insights from the data. But unfortunately, the data misses, like, most of the API code. So everything that you can generate with this is not working.
That is why I mentioned that this is only one part of the access analyzer. Yeah. And this is only the part that basically generates a policy out of the CloudTrail event. I think this feature is more or less useless because the data source, the CloudTrail events, are not complete. Yeah. Then you can basically not build a product on that. Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But there is another part of the access analyzer, which is the part that you mentioned. This is where they just look at the policy and they try to figure out if this policy makes any sense. So they find things like you're granting access to another account.
Okay, here.
Is that intended? Stuff like that.
Okay.
So I think you need to distinguish between those two things.
Okay.
I think the one is where their fancy reasoning goes into, and the other one is completely useless, more or less.
So maybe there's no fancy reasoning at all here.
Okay. And basically the results from the other one, the reports from the access analyzer, they're at least interesting to do reviews of your S3 bucket policies, IAM roles, and stuff like that. So I looked through those. It was nothing surprising for me, but it still was a nice tool to go over those things.
All right. So sorry for that. That's it, right? And that was your news.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the next one that I picked, and I kind of notice a pattern here. I always pick very tiny changes, and you pick the bigger ones. So at least the ones that need more explanation. So my next change from last week is that AWS Lambda functions powered by Graviton 2 are now available in 12 additional regions, and I think that kind of increases the region coverage quite significantly. So more or less everyone can now move to Graviton 2 if they wish. And what AWS says is probably you can just, I mean, there's not much reasons not to do it because all the code should, I mean, if you don't do fancy things, then your code should just work on Graviton 2. And we actually did that. So we have this like software as a service called Marbot, which is a chatbot that helps you to monitor and set up the monitoring for your AWS account. And we enabled, or we migrated to Graviton 2 basically there. And now it gets interesting because AWS kind of announced that a new feature with the idea that you can get up to 90% better performance and at 20% lower costs. So we deployed the change and we don't see any difference in any of our metrics. So the latency and stuff is still exactly the same. So I cannot say that we benefit like from a performance perspective from this. I guess we will see next month a 20% decrease in our Lambda bill, which is, as Andreas calculated, I think it's at the moment $3, so it will go down to $2.40, so we will save $0.60. So after a year, that will be $7, which is great. So yeah.
10 years and the change is worth the time that I put into there.
Yeah, but it's still cool. So it now runs on ARM-based processors, right? And the only thing that we need to change was we have to make a change in our CloudFormation templates. And that's it. Everything is working.
Cool. Yeah, cool stuff. So in general, I'm a big fan of Graviton 2. I think that makes a lot of things better. I'm also a big fan of my ARM processor in my MacBook, so yay ARM. Cool stuff. So but the last announcement that I picked is AWS IQ now supports partners and independent consultants in Australia, Europe, Japan and other regions. So this is probably big news for a lot of people. So what is AWS IQ? So basically this is a platform that AWS customers can connect to AWS experts, either partners or, so that means consulting boutiques or consulting firms and independent consultants. And so I think the only ones that could participate so far were based in the US and probably also the UK. I don't remember correctly, but I think that it is. So now more people in the world can register and basically offer their skills, their expertise through that marketplace, because that's what it is. It's a marketplace for AWS experts. And I think the most important thing about the marketplace is the customers are paying through their AWS bill for that. And that is an important thing when you run a business, because you're making it very easy for your customers to pay you. It just goes through the same process that other things go through already, and it might not even maybe no one notices in your organization that you hired someone through AWS IQ, at least to a certain amount. And also, even the fee is quite fair, I would say. This is not typical for Amazon, I would say. So the fee is 2.5%. So if you compare that to selling books on Amazon or something, that is almost for free. And but still, I would highly warn anyone to use AWS IQ to offer your services through AWS IQ, because I think this is really a race to the bottom. So what we will see there. So now I think it's still a good time probably to sell your services there. You're starting with probably very good rates there. I have heard about people that are making really good money on AWS IQ, but I think it will be a race to the bottom over time. And here's why. If you go to AWS IQ and you basically ask for help for a certain project, you will see freelancers applying to help you. And basically what you see is their AWS certifications and their reviews. And that's all you get. So that's all you get as an independent consultant to build your brand or to distinguish yourself from the others. So that's basically more or less nothing, right? So you have AWS certifications. Over time, everyone will have all the AWS certifications, so there will be no distinguishing factor on that. And reviews, okay. So this is maybe a little... So we all know how to get reviews, like you ask a few friends and start with very small projects or stuff like that. So it's not really a distinguish, allows you to distinguish from others as well. So I think, yeah, this is really, at the end, it's about the cost. It's about the price tag that you have on your request, on your offering for the request. And so over time, this is a race to the bottom. The rates will go down significantly as you will start competing to people all over the world that have more or less the same skill set than you. And I think you should probably build a more sustainable business over other channels. That's my take on AWS IQ. Okay, so I think this covers the announcement that we identified as important in the past week. And let's have a short break, because we want to announce a few sponsors, a few partners. And so we talked about AWS expertise with AWS IQ right before that. And we all know that AWS expertise is in high demand. So if you are looking for a job, I have two interesting offerings for you. So first of all, our partner Demicon is hiring a cloud solutions architect with focus on AWS, working remotely from somewhere in the EU. So if you bring expertise in AWS, DevOps, infrastructure as code, continuous delivery, this is something for you. So this is a remote first company, consulting company. And if that sounds interesting to you, you will find a link where you can apply for that job in the show notes. And also our partner TechRacer is hiring cloud consultants focusing on AWS serverless development. So you should apply for this when you like building serverless applications with Lambda, TypeScript, also Go, I think is a possible CDK. And you can join TechRacer in Hanover, Duisburg, Frankfurt, Hamburg, Munich. So that's their German offices. Then we have Vienna, Lisbon, and Lucerne within the EU. So apply for that if serverless development is what you are looking for, or what you like to do, basically.
All right. So that sounds great. So if you're interested in doing that all day, then this is definitely something to check out. All right, Andreas. So now I have a story to share, or a lesson learned from last week. And what I did is I developed a new feature for Marbot, and I talked about that before, right? So this is the little chatbot that works on Slack on Teams that helps you with the AWS monitoring. And basically what I was doing is, when a new alert arrives in the system, I want to enrich this alert with additional data. So for example, if a CloudWatch alarm arrives, I want to enrich it with the CloudWatch metric graph so that you can see, okay, this was the metric like a couple of hours before and a couple of minutes after the alarm fired. So this was one of the things. Then we also have additional enrichments for other services, but that basically doesn't matter. So when a new alarm arrives, I want to do something in the background, and once I have the data, I can add it to the alert, and then I update the Slack or the Teams message. So what we have, and we had this in place already, is a DynamoDB stream for the table that stores the alerts. And yes, we are storing alerts here, so we are not putting everything into a single table, so I'm not a big fan of that. So we have an alerts table, and there we store the alerts, and when something changes, the DynamoDB stream is updated, and then a Lambda function listens on that stream. And what I did at the beginning and was that when an alert was inserted, I did something with the alert. And then a couple of days later, I had a clever idea that maybe I should also do that when an alert is updated. And the problem is that when I do this enrichment, I also update the alert item itself in the table. And because I now also react to modify events in my stream, I created an infinite loop, because every time something changed, I changed it again. And this is, I know that this is a problem. Also, I should know that this is a problem, but in this case, it was like from looking at the code, it was not obvious that, I will run into this problem here, because this was just like a couple of functions down, I made a change to the DynamoDB table. And then I deployed this, and I was kind of wondered, so why is there activity in the dev environment in the stream, like minutes after I sent the alert into the system? And then I noticed, oh, okay, it's always the same ID. So what's wrong here? And then I figured out, okay. So then the problem was figuring out who makes this change. And then it took me some time, because it's not in the stream data, that like the principle is not in the stream data. And I mean, it took me some time to figure it out. And then I also, like, by looking at the code, and that's obviously not a good idea. And yeah, we all know that's a problem. And with S3 buckets and things, I think everyone sooner or later will create such an infinite loop with Lambda functions. And the good news here is that the latency is quite high. So when you change something and then it takes some time until it appears in the stream, and because of that, I was not, the build was not really going up very significantly, because it's so slow, basically, the infinite loop. And like, if you do this with S3, it can be really, really quickly. So I created such an S3 infinite loop, and it really changes your AWS build within a short amount of time, significantly. So this is, yeah, just a reminder. I don't know how to really prevent this situation, because at least the code that we have, it's not obvious what really goes on, and where the side effects are in DynamoDB if I call this function and stuff. So yeah, I think it's a funny story, and everyone can kind of laugh about that. And I think the idea here is to remind everyone that if you change from this like insert to also react on modify, you have to be a little bit careful if you modify the item itself here. So yeah, keep that in mind when you work with DynamoDB streams to do some background processing of items. So for example, yeah, there's all kinds of things that you could do here. And it's a really nice feature, and I still like it, the DynamoDB streams approach, because it's very easy to plug something in. I mean, it could be implemented with Event Bridge or something else, SNS as well, but it's really nice because you have some kind of, the data is already there and things like that. So that's my kind of learning, or my kind of, it's not really, I relearned it, basically. I made the same mistake in the past.
Relearned the hard way.
Yes, but this time it was not so painful, because everything's a little bit slower in DynamoDB streams.
Yeah.
Okay, Andreas, that was most my little story from last week's programming experience.
Okay, thank you very much, Michael, for sharing that. Okay. So last but not least, it's time to answer your questions. So basically, we collect your questions that you can send us over the week. So use the hashtag AskCloudOnOut, send us a message over Twitter or LinkedIn. Also, feel free to email us or leave a comment somewhere. We will find it. That's basically what Cadian did on YouTube. He left the following questions, a question in the comments. I'd like to know your strategy for blue-green deployments. In particular, how do you know which color is deployed next or which color is currently active? I've seen this solved in a few different ways. I wonder what your strategy is. Thanks. Okay. So let me try to answer. Or maybe, can you start, Michael? You do have been a better answer to that.
So I don't think that I have a very good answer. So the first thing is that we don't really do blue-green deployments. So that's one thing to keep in mind. I think the support of the tooling space in AWS is not very great at blue-green deployments as well. I think that's why the question is about how to implement this, because it's really something that you have to do on your own. What we do instead is that when we deploy to EC2 instances, we use CloudFormation, which has an update policy, and we can do this rolling update. And if things go wrong, it basically, I mean, you can configure it in a way that it spins up new instances first, and then it can roll back and use the old ones, or you can also configure it in a way that it terminates the old ones first and adds new ones. But this is, it's not blue-green, but it's kind of, it's also kind of, I mean, it's safe in different ways, but it's good enough for our use cases. So we can go back to the last AMI basically quickly, because we have old versions running. I mean, not 100% at some point in time, but enough to shift the traffic back to the old version. And we also have two versions running at the same time. That's the main strategy for EC2. For Lambda, we don't do any of that. We just deploy the new version, and if things go kind of wrong, we fix and go forward. And this is like in our situation, we don't need to be able to kind of roll back a deployment. And I think it's really like if you start thinking about this, then you also have to start thinking about what are the consequences of this. Because what about your data? So if you all your changes then need to be able to also work with the new data, but it's still the old code and things like, I mean, it makes things a lot more complicated, and this is super hard to test for. So I think it could also be very, I think most blue green deployments will just fail if they roll back, if the data structure was changed, because it, I don't think that most code bases will handle that properly. And so yeah, that's just my take. So I know that, I mean, there are large companies that need to do that, and I think they have like, or they put effort into making sure that they can do it properly. But if you are working in a smaller company or the app is like smaller, I don't think that it's worthwhile to invest in that. I don't know, what's your take on that, Andreas?
Yeah, so obviously we're not doing real blue-green deployments. I think one other approach that I'm using is with Terraform, because there is no rolling update as it is with CloudFormation for the autoscaling group. With Terraform, what I'm doing is I'm using, is it called a replace policy or something? So I basically make sure that the autoscaling group, that it creates a new autoscaling group each time I do a deployment. And basically what Terraform does, it spins up a new autoscaling group, it spins up new instances, and after they are ready, it deletes the old autoscaling group. So this is also not 100% blue-green deployment, because you don't have control over that process, but it's going in the same direction than what you described. You're bringing up the new version, waiting till it's working, and then you are removing the old one. And I think one service that comes to my mind is Code Deploy. In theory, is I think covering use cases like that, but it's in my experience a little inconvenient to get started with, or I'd never get into the service 100%, because it's a little it's a little bit complicated or clumsy. Yeah.
I think. The main problem of Code Deploy is that because we manage all the infrastructure with CloudFormation or Terraform, is it makes changes to your infrastructure, and that's kind of a problem because it modifies your load balances, your autoscaling groups, and all kinds of things, and that's not cool because I do that with CloudFormation, so please don't do it. So my experience with Code Deploy is it always clashes, because we don't. Well, I don't know if it's really useful for anyone. That automates infrastructure creation, because it really changes your infrastructure, and that's not what I want. Sorry again. Like, this is like last time we also had a good answer for the question. So questions are really hard here. So maybe you can ask questions that are easier to answer next time.
I think it's fine.
No, but I think it's an interesting question. Yeah. And it definitely shows a pain point in AWS. So this is not solved. So Code Deploy does not solve that problem. So please fix that, AWS. Make it better and work compatible with CloudFormation. Yeah.
Okay, Michael. So we have one more question from the chat. Shabraham writes in and he asks, how can I improve my AWS security?
Yep.
Let me this time start answering the question. You can jump in later. So I think what comes to my mind right away when reading that question is a blog post that you have written a long time ago. I think it's still relevant. It's called the AWS Security Primer, and it contains a mind map that you can find copied all over the web. So that's probably the most stolen content asset from our site. And basically, the mind map gives you an overview of all or of the important aspects of AWS security. And I think this is a very good starting point because, yeah, there's a lot of different things to consider from a technical side of things. So definitely one aspect is the AWS API, and there is the IAM, Identity and Access Management Service, that you use to control access to this AMI. And then there are a lot of details to that. So you have things like IAM roles, you have things like policies that you need to check for least privilege, you have resource-based policies for S3 and other resource types. So there's a lot to that. And I think it's when it comes to security, it's important to have really an overview, but also have really able to go into the details, because in the details, it is when we do reviews of accounts on infrastructures, it's always the details that matter, because all those tools, all those security tools like the security hub or, I don't know, third-party tools that you're paying for, they all scan your accounts for the simple things. Yeah, they are all scan your accounts for the things that they can simply identify in your accounts and send you a report out of that. But in my experience, in the detail, it is the most interesting when it comes to security. So your IAM policy, assume role policy, who is allowed to use that role, stuff like that. That's where it's interesting. And of course, there are other areas. So there's the whole networking stuff with VPC. Of course, you need to be aware of everything there. So the firewall configurations, network configurations, monitoring configuration for that. There's data encryption. So encrypt data at rest and in transit. Other things like service-specific things. So with EC2, how do you connect to your EC2 instances with SSH, with RDP? Are you using key pairs? How do you manage them? Stuff like that. So I think there are very specific problems to specific services. Is there anything you want to add, Michael?
Yeah, I want to add two aspects. And the first one is, and this is a blog post, Andreas, that you wrote, so I will cite that as well. So it's called the Security Iceberg, AWS Security Iceberg. So please don't turn on Security Hub and then spend all your time making sure that all the findings are resolved. This is in most, really most findings are not really improving your security. So I think what you should do, you should enable Security Hub, yes, and you should have you should understand what's going on there. But what you should do most of your time, if you really want to increase your AWS security, I think what I would do is I would ask a coworker, okay, please sit down with me for 1 hour, and we just randomly pick IAM roles or IAM users, and we will look at the policies. And then try to understand why all these actions are enabled. Like why is all this access required? So this is what we call a review. And I think this is still the only really useful way in AWS IAM to make sure that you periodically check all the policies with different people, probably not only the author, maybe also another pair of eyes, and really question all the access that is granted there. And so this is, I think, our experience, Andreas, right? That this is the only way to get IAM policies right and also keep them right, because things change. And this is your focus. I think this is the area where I would focus. There are lots of additional stuff that you can do, but if you don't get the IAM policies right, then all the rest is not really interesting for you. So that would be my advice. So have reviews of IAM policies, sit down with a coworker and just go and look through your IAM policies.
Yeah, I think I would add something on a more general level. So I think it is important to build up knowledge on AWS security, on all the details. Because I think with just high-level knowledge of all those things, you're not really going to identify the important aspects here in your environments. So I think it's really important to learn about AWS security in detail. Start somewhere, use our mind map as a starting point, and then really dive into all those details very deeply. because otherwise you will not be able to identify the important things. And even if you use tooling that generates findings for you, you need to know about what's behind those things. Is it an important finding or not? You need to be able to distinguish the important stuff from the unimportant stuff. And I think there's no shortcut than really getting into the details. So maybe start with our mind map. I think it gives you a good overview of the important areas, and then just try to build up knowledge in all those areas step by step. I know it's a lot. When you look at the mind map, you might be scared, but build up that knowledge over time. Start with what Michael said, DIAM, Identity and Access Management Service. Start with that and then go into the other areas as well.
Yep. So that's, I think, a good answer. I mean, there's not, no, it's probably not a good answer, but it's the only answer. So a lot of work, yeah.
So we have a, I think we have a follow-up question from Keith about the blue-green deployment methods. And the question is,
okay,
what about using canary deployment? It works similar to blue-green, but it's slightly different because you want to only hand over a small amount of traffic to see if things are working, and then switch over if everything is fine. So basically, I think the idea here is you are testing in production by sending small amounts of traffic to the new version, monitor very closely what happens, and then switch the rest of the traffic to that. So Michael, I think the answer to that is similar to what we answered before. We are not actively using that. I think the service that is in theory capable of doing so is Code Deploy. I think that's correct, Michael, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, but I think the problem here is still that we don't do it because the tooling in AWS is not really useful. Because what you can do with Code Deploy is you can say, okay, this this percentage of traffic is going to this new Lambda version. I think that's what you can do. But, I mean, that's not really what you want to do, right? You want to send X amount of your users to this new version. I mean, you don't want to randomly kind of pick that, like the request, and send it to something. At least that's my understanding of how this should be done. But yeah, it's, I don't know. I think you will have to spend a lot of effort in implementing this, because this is something that you need to do. It's not kind of out of the box available. And you have to monitor this as well. You have to, like, you need additional metrics that only monitor that kind of traffic. And that's, I mean, with CloudWatch, how do you kind of distinguish this version from the other by looking at the default metrics? It's not possible, right? So you have to know, okay, this version generates this metric, the other version generates those metrics. And if something goes wrong in the new version, you can roll back, or I don't know, you look at all the metrics and then you roll back. So I think it's not really easy to do it at the moment. And
I think, as you mentioned before, the question is it really worth, so as there's no built-in tooling that really helps us doing that easily, is it worth the effort implementing stuff like that for the standard web application that we all built, that are not building for, I don't know, Amazon Com or something?
I think yes. So that's probably is kind of a good indication. So if your application is really very, very important and receives a lot of traffic and generates a lot of money, then probably it makes sense to build that capability. But you have to build it on your own, and it's expensive to do that. And if you are just like running a more or less like usual web application or something, then I think no one will invest that money. To implement it properly, because you have to do that properly, because otherwise you will just, I mean, then you can also just roll out the thing if you cannot really detect if it is a difference to the other version. So,
So that's our answer to that. So one idea that comes to mind is the whole feature flag approach, and there might be app config that you could use for that to turn on a feature for a certain amount of customers only, and use stuff like that to build similar things. But still, I think to get that to 100% with all the things that you mentioned, monitoring only those parts of the traffic and stuff like that, I think it's a lot of work to get all that up and running. But I think that's maybe something that might help going into that direction a little bit. So we are doing that, right, Michael? You have been doing it for Marbot with basically a feature flag. You're releasing new important releases, and you only enable it for a few customers. That's basically a little bit like a canary release.
It overlaps a lot. It's kind of a feature flag, but it's also like more or less the same thing. So we can test a new feature in production with a like very small amount of users, and this helps us to get confidence that it's working before we turn it on for everyone. So for example, with the change that I made last week that I mentioned with the CloudWatch metric graphs, this runs in production, but only for very, very few customers. And in our case, we can also have like different Kinesis streams for different customers. So we can, like, by enabling this change, we know that it only, like, if it really kind of creates a larger problem in the system, it only affects a very small amount of our overall customers. And if you have this kind of separation, then I think you can do this. But this also, you always have to keep in mind if you do something like this, that now we have code running that for some customers changes, because this required some new attributes in our DynamoDB table, for example. And now we see those attributes for some customers, but not for others. And I mean, because we only added something, we know that the old code still works, but you always have to be kind of building the new thing in a way that doesn't affect the old customers. So you have to keep that in mind. So there's no way to kind of migrate the data or something like this. So if you do data migrations, like making changes to the table or something like this in a release, then this is not going to work. So yeah, but I think this is a good example of a very low cost. This is low cost shipping features to a small set of features. We don't even use app config or any of that stuff to do it. We just have in our code, you have a function that says, is this a beta tester? And we put in the ID of the team and it says true or false. That's it. And that's our way of making this decision. And yeah, I mean, that could be also worthwhile. Like, don't do all this fancy stuff. Just like do it in a very cost-effective way.
Yeah. And also I think then it makes sense. So what we do with that approach is we only do that for important changes. So when we roll out a change that is a very small one, just optimizing a tiny bit, we don't do a feature toggle for just enabling for a few customers. We just roll it out to everyone. And if we do a bigger release that we expect that might break something in production, we then use that approach to mitigate the risk of affecting all of our customers at once. I think that's also a good approach.
So I hope that helped a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks a lot for asking your questions in the chat. So. We will try to continue streaming this weekly show on YouTube. And next time we also plan to announce it a little bit bigger. Thanks for joining this. Also, thanks for listening and watching this. We'll be back in a week. See you then. Bye, Michael.
Bye. Thanks.